Hi, this is Mike McNamara, and you're listening to All Marine Radio on your home for it, the one and only All Warrior Radio Network. This is part two in a battlefield study series, and Daryl's from Arkansas, so I didn't play Mick Jagger this time. I figured that he might be a country and western music fan, so not sure if he is, but I took the chance. So, Daryl, welcome back to All Marine Radio. Thanks for doing this. Thanks for doing more of this.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
All right. Now, if you haven't heard the first part of this, hit the pause button, all right? Go in, and you'll find part one of this. Listen to that, because it's Daryl's story leading up to his deployment to Vietnam and his service with Bravo Company, 1st Battalion, 9th Marines during Operation Buffalo. And so that's where we kind of left off the interview. Before we get going, though, Daryl, there's a picture that I've included in the first podcast, and I'll include in this. And it's a picture of you digging a fighting position. And you're down in the earth about waist deep. And I'm just curious, something as a grunt that would catch my eye, that's a pretty deep fighting position. Probably one you might only be occupying for a night and part of a day. Can you tell us about how deep you guys normally dug when you went out? Because that's a serious fighting hole you're in.
That's true. Yeah, and it kind of depends on, like you say, how long we were going to be there. If we're going to be there for a full night, maybe a day, we're going to dig a hole probably waist deep and big enough for two men and our 60-millimeter mortar. And, if we don't have the time, then we'll leave the mortar out and just dig it big enough for one. But we like to dig it a deep one like that and be ready for whatever's going to happen.
All right. And so normally that was deeper than waist deep?
Yeah, it's about waist deep.
Okay. All right. And so that would be for two people, and for you guys being mortarmen, the mortar in there too. And that was because the lethality of the North Vietnamese artillery and mortars that were north of the DMZ.
Yes, and when they hit nearby, you've got a place to get down where they possibly won't get you unless it's real close.
All right. So let's just to reset a little bit. You are at the time of this, you're a PFC or a Lance Corporal?
I'm a Lance Corporal.
All right. So you're a Lance Corporal, and inside, the 60 mortar section of Bravo Company, what was your job?
At that time I was gunner for the first couple of weeks. I was a ammo carrier. And then at this point I was gunner because, some people had been wounded and some had gone home.
Right.
I moved up pretty rapidly.
Yeah, so been there a month and already got promoted. So for those of you who aren't familiar with mortars, the gunner is the guy who you'll see take the round and drop it to a position that's called half load, and then when the team leader says fire, he drops the round. So that would have been Daryl. So
right.
All right, so rolling around with a 45, and then carrying pieces of the mortar system, so the tripod, the tube, and the base plate, and the sight all compose the system. So more than a little bit of gear when it was as hot as humid as it was in Vietnam. Now there's two maps that go along with it. One is I've labeled map 21, and one I've labeled map 20. Now, map 21, I got out of a book, and I enhanced the graphics a little bit. And so you'll see at the top of it, it says 2 July 1967, all positions are approximate. So that's and I kind of colorized some of that stuff, and so it would jump out at you. And then I took that along with a kind of another picture of the Kantian Firebase, and I superimposed that on a Google Earth image, and that's map 22. So when we're talking about maps today, those will be the two maps that we talk about. So, Daryl, we got as far as the night of 1-2 July. And you guys, if everybody can look at map 22, Bravo Company spends the night in just north of the Trace, and in the, on the morning of July 2nd, they begin to head north. So, Daryl, anything the night of 1-2 July, anything exciting happened that night?
Well, that night was very, there was just a lot of stress, you know, because we knew there were a lot of NVA out in the area. And as we dug in, we started digging in, and then when it started getting dark, we moved to another place just to confuse the enemy, hopefully.
Right.
Anyway, during the night, we could hear them mortaring another area not too far away. And which we thought at the time they just were planning on or trying to find us, but they were actually planning on where they thought we were going the next day. And so the next morning when we all got up and headed out, we were tired and weary, and we hadn't slept much because we'd been on 75% alert all night. And so we had a lot of bloodshot eyes and tired feelings and. But anyway, we headed out early that morning around 7 a.m.
Got it. And you guys are headed north, and that highway is called what, 571?
It's I believe 561.
Yeah. So you guys are essentially headed up 561. Explain what is 561? Just a wider dirt trail, or is it a paved?
Yes.
Is it a paved road, improved road?
No, it's just a dirt trail, more like a cow trail.
All right. So you guys are headed north, and you're headed towards something called the Marketplace.
Right.
Had you been up there before?
I had not been there before.
Got it.
C Company had been there before, but we had not. It was our first time out there.
Everybody a little bit tired. The heat's coming in Vietnam, and you guys are headed north. And you're with the point platoon, right? You're with third platoon.
Actually, we were kind of near the end. I think I said third, but I believe second. I think third went first, and then second, and then us. And you know, we done like a 2-hour sweep, and we ended up, I don't know, within 1,200 meters or so of the Trace, which is known as the McNamara Strip. And that strip was supposed to be in like 600 to 1,000 meters wide with barbed wire, minefields, sensors, watchtowers, all kinds of stuff to stop the enemy from crossing over and bringing supplies. But the strip ended up being like a 600-meter wide strip with nothing else to keep the enemy out.
Got it.
Anyway, yeah. And we moved on up north along Route 561, and we had some sniper fire. And our company commander had the 1st Platoon to send out a squad to check out the snipers, not knowing what we were walking into, and had that platoon to stay back because we were supposed to be resupplied with water and food. And so they were to stay back and get our supplies and then catch back up with us. But, go ahead.
So it just so I can have this in my head. So 3rd Platoon's in the lead, and you guys are right. you guys are at the end of 3rd Platoon in front of 2nd Platoon, or are you at the end of 2nd Platoon?
We're at the end of 2nd Platoon at that point.
Okay.
3rd Platoon leads in, 2nd Platoon, and then we're behind them.
And then 1st Platoon is behind you?
Yeah, but they're way behind us because they're back waiting on supplies.
Got it. Got it. And where you were overnight, yes?
Well, no, it was just before we entered into the trace.
Okay.
And we got the Schnauzer fire. Yeah.
Got it.
And they were remaining back there.
Okay.
Not knowing what we were headed for at the time.
Right. So you guys approach the marketplace, and then there's at the marketplace, you get is that where you get sniper fire in vicinity of that?
Well, when we entered the marketplace, it's when we really ran into hellfire. Yeah.
All right. So third platoon's pushed out in front of you, and you guys are kind of moving through the marketplace, and you know this is bad guy country. And you hear the first sniper fire, and you guys begin to now do what all military units do, which is kind of, you know, put their hands out in front of them, and you start feeling for the enemy, and we call it developing the enemy's disposition, right? Developing the situation. So you hear that, but did you guys set up your mortars yet? Were you still just moving with 2nd Platoon?
No, yeah, we were still just moving. We were all moving at that point. And as 3rd Platoon went first, and as they entered into the marketplace, that's when all the firing and mortars started. They were letting everything loose at that point. And the orders were given for an 8-man rifle squad and 2-man gun team to walk point for Bravo at that time, for 2nd Platoon. And then Sergeant Ray's 3rd Platoon was leading Bravo company as we reached the marketplace. And that's when all the hell broke loose right there. They were set up and waiting for us.
So can you describe, I have yet to see a good diagram, but from the descriptions that I've read about the fire that you guys walked into, you walk into, it seems like a extremely well concealed kind of a horseshoe shape or a crescent shape ambush. Is that fair?
Absolutely. It was a U shaped ambush. Is what it amounted to. And they had it set up really well, walked right into it.
So, you know, I think that you know, those of us that are infantrymen, you know, we get educated about, you know, what do you do when you're in a near ambush, and the Marine Corps, you know, what I got taught is, look, if you're in a near ambush, there is the quick and the dead. And you have to assault through the ambush, which is you got to throw grenades, you got to throw smoke, you got to throw everything you can. And you, because if you try to run away, you're too close to them, they'll kill you. So, I mean, that was your experience that day, Daryl. So you guys begin to fight and your casualties are atrocious. And at some point, the company, you know, the commander and the command group is killed. Walk us through, you know, the early part of that fight, and then what you guys did as mortarmen, because in that fight, I mean, you guys have a role to, you know, to suppress the enemy, to give everybody else some time to react. So, talk to me about the initial part of the fight.
Okay. Well, first you need to know that there were 150 Marines, and we were battling 5,000. NBA. We didn't know it at the time. We had no idea. But the 3rd and the 2nd platoons that had gone up on ahead of us had pretty much been annihilated just instantly. And our company commander asked for Sergeant Burns, who was in charge of the 1st platoon, to get on up and support us. Well, he was already in trouble, so he couldn't move. He was pinned down. They were pinned down, so we couldn't depend on them. They were having their own problems. They were, you know, fighting their own lives at that point. And so that's when we set up our mortars, began firing support for what was left of the platoons. And the enemy was dropping 82-millimeter mortars, rockets, and whatever they could throw at us, along with small arms and grenades. But with our mortars, we pretty much right away knocked out two of their positions. And then it was so severe that we finally ended up just putting our mortar almost straight up in the air and taking the increments, most of them off of the mortars, so that they would fall short. So we were almost dropping it on our own positions, you know.
Right.
And even though we got two of their positions, there were still plenty left. And they were everywhere. They were in trees, trenches, spider holes, you name it, they were there. And we fired our mortars and we just kept going. We were doing lots of damage, and we could hear the enemy screaming, you know, with pain, and we knew we were doing some damage, but not near enough because they had a lot more power than we did.
Right.
And so we were firing off our rounds as fast as we could. And
hey, Daryl, let me ask you, how many rounds would you guys carry? Because I mean, at that, you know, a 60 mortar section carries what they can carry, and then guys in the company carry rounds too. So can you explain how much ammunition you guys had that day?
Yeah, at that point we normally carried about 4 rounds ourselves each. And then everybody in the platoons carried 1 round. And so when we were setting up a position, they'd just come by and drop off their round. So we usually had plenty. But we didn't have all that. We didn't have all those at that point because 2 of the companies had pretty well been wiped out and the other one was back behind us. So we only had, I don't know, probably 10 or 15 rounds. And I can't even remember. I just remember we were firing. We ran out too soon. And so then me and my gunner jumped in a bomb crater, you know, for our protection. And there was so much explosion going on around us, we could hardly see anything or anybody. And at this point, I was telling the guy that was with me that we were going to have to get out of there because we were going to be captured or killed. So we decided we were going to run, and I was the first one. And Tom, the guy that was in there with me, Tom, he was going to give me protection. Well, he got up and fired once as I ran, and his rifle jammed after the first shot because of all the dirt and junk that we'd been in. And so here I am just running, you know, with the bullets flying, hitting ground around me, and grenades going off, and I was running a zigzag pattern trying to get, you know, to a safe place, which I did. And I know the good Lord just made a schedule of protection around me there at that point. But because I could just feel one of those bullets at any time. But anyway, I reached a couple other guys that were nearby, and then we gave Hines protection. And we got to move on around, and we ended up finding 6 more guys, so we had 8 at the time. And so we made our way. We're trying to get back to the landing zone.
Which was south of you guys?
Yeah, it's back. Yeah, back behind us, quite a ways, and back in that area where the first platoon was back, pretty close to that area. So it wasn't an easy place to go to either.
Right. Hey, Daryl, let me ask you. I mean, so how much time elapses? I mean, so this thing explodes in your guy's face, this horseshoe ambush, right? 3rd platoon is pretty much wiped out. 2nd platoon pretty much wiped out. You guys, as you said, but for the grace of God, are still alive. How much time has elapsed in all of that?
Probably, I don't know, maybe a couple hours.
Got it.
If that long. It's hard for me to remember. It seemed like an eternity.
Right. I can only imagine. At what point do you lose your company commander in the command group? Is that pretty early in the fight?
Yeah, it was pretty early. Matter of fact, my company commander had called our main commander at Compton, and ask him to send help. Said if we don't get help pretty soon, we're in bad trouble. And of course, that didn't happen. Just pretty much after he'd made the call, that him and all the group there were killed.
And that's Captain Coates.
Yeah.
Got it. Okay. So all this, all that transpires in the space of, you know, an hour or two.
Right. Yeah. This battle went on all day. I mean, from 9 in the morning until evening before we got help, you know. And we got plenty of help at that time, but it was pretty much too late.
So if we just say that it's approximately 11 o'clock when you and Tom Hines and six other Marines, you know, gathered, to, you know, wind up together.
Right.
Is the time between 11 in the morning and 7 in the evening, is that just you guys on your own fighting it out with groups of North Vietnamese that are going to come look for you and kill you?
Right. Yeah, it's pretty much the way it was. The guys, we had found a trail and set up our perimeter, four on each side, pretty much thinking it was our last hurrah. We thought it might be our last stand. And because we could hear the enemy coming and screaming, they were shooting at our wounded and killing them, and mortars and rockets were falling all around us. And we had the NVA were walking up on us. One of them walked up close, and he had his AK-47 pointed at me, and I had my .45 pistol. And as I fired, I screamed at my friend across the aisle, Ronnie Fields. And Ronnie, like a crazy Marine, he just dove right out in the trail and started firing his M16. So we had bullets flying from my .45, his M16, and the AK-47. And after a few seconds, it was quiet, and the enemy was dead, and Ronnie had been shot twice. And surprisingly enough, I was still okay. Right after that, I looked up and one of the enemies was throwing a grenade in my direction. So I dove into the dirt, covered my face, but the grenade went off over my head and filled my ears with little pieces of shrapnel and caused me to be temporarily deaf for a short period of time. And then one of our guys cut him down. So we're still eight strong at this point. And so then we start trying to work our way out, but the NVA are setting the grass and everything on fire with their flamethrowers.
Now, let me ask you this. You know, when we read about that, most Marines are stunned to read of that in fact, the NVA used flamethrowers. And Daryl, I just want to tell you, that's what one of the things, that's why I think that this, you know, Marines learning about what you guys, you know, what you guys did, you know, what you guys fought through, in my opinion, is so important, because when we talk about fighting a peer, this is what we're talking about. And so, you know, it's easy to say, you know, something like, oh, yeah, it's like this, and it's like this, and it's like this. But it's guys like Daryl that actually, you know, that actually live this. And so had you ever been told that you know, that they had flamethrowers and that this was a part of what they would bring to the fight?
No, we really didn't have any idea what they had. They were equipped, you know, with mortars, rockets, flamethrowers, you name it, they had it.
Right.
And, you know, it was like five battalions, so they had plenty, and they were using those flamethrowers to flush us out. and it was happening because every time somebody ran out, it got too hot and they'd shoot them. And so that was working. But we were still trying to make our way back to the elderly. And I was, one guy had been shot in the hip and I was helping him, dragging him along. And we had to leave our mortar. And later when the tanks came, they ran over it so the enemy couldn't get it. But anyway, we were moving, and all of a sudden the mortar started falling all around us, and we had no place to go, so we were just hugging each other in the ground, and I felt this excruciating pain in my left arm. I thought I'd lost it, but it was just shrapnel, and I was relieved. And I managed to pull out most of it, but there's still three pieces in there today. I guess I'll live with it. And
So explain that. So, Daryl, so you see you get wounded, and I think a lot of, when you talk to guys that have been wounded, their first idea is like, what just happened? And then they look, could you see the wound? Right, and in the midst of this, you still got to fight and whatnot. Did you dress your own wound? Did somebody else dress your wound? How did all that work?
No, there wasn't any dressing. It was pretty much just packed with dirt and keep going.
Got it.
Mine wasn't severe like so many of them. Just shrapnel in my arm and in my ears, and I was still in fair condition in comparison to a lot of the guys.
Now at this point, can you, when you go temporarily deaf like that, I mean, people are moving their lips, but you can't even hear what they're, I mean, you don't, and they could be relatively close to you. You still can't hear what they're saying. So you're still in that kind of state where, unless somebody yells at you, you pretty much don't understand what they're saying.
Right, yeah. And that was a brief time, probably, 30, 40 minutes, and then I was beginning to hear again.
Got it.
For a little bit, it was just, all you could hear was screaming in your ears.
Right. So talk to me about what happens after. So now this is in the afternoon as you guys are trying to fight your way south. Have you seen any other Marines? Have you linked up? Has your group gotten any larger at this point?
Well, not much, just the wounded Marines that we were trying to help and bandage up and trying to take with us. And we probably up to maybe a dozen at that point. But most of them were unable to fight.
Right.
And they were at the point to where they had to help each other even to load their rifles,
Now, do you have any recollection, Daryl, of where you guys are now in proximity to the marketplace? Are you still close to the marketplace? Are you a few hundred meters south of it by then?
Yeah, we're probably 100, 150 meters south of it by this point. We're still trying to get back to the LZ to get our wounded back so we can hopefully get them out.
And that's where First Platoon is, south of you.
Yeah, they're close in that area. They're not where the LZ is.
Got it.
But they should have been, but they wasn't. But they were pinned down as well, and they lost most of their guys too.
So. And now let's talk about, support. Alpha companies off to the west, and they're fighting for their lives as well. Contien is over, is southwest of you, but there's no forward observers. There's no radio. I would imagine, the platoon commanders are dead. The radio operators are dead. And so the only radio really is down with First Platoon, and nobody has one. And so the battalion doesn't know what's going on at all, so they can't help either, correct? And I'm sure, in fact, accounts I've read say we could hear the firing, right, coming to the north and to the northeast, but we only had contact with Alpha Company. We didn't have contact with Bravo Company after the Captain Coates' last transmission.
Right. That was the end of the transmission there. And so, they really didn't know. They knew we were in trouble. They just didn't know how bad.
Got it.
And so they did send out other, some of our other companies came to our rescue, and some other battalions. And so we were getting some help. But the thing that helped us most, I guess, was the tanks and the jets.
When do they show up later that afternoon? And you guys, so now you're a dozen, with a fair amount of wounded, limping to the south. And at what point do the tanks show up? And what point does air check on station? Because when you read about these fights, and we talked about it in part one of this, the North Vietnamese, they used to call it hugging, right? Right, hugging, Marines and hugging soldiers, and what that meant was they knew if they did not stay close, so that they couldn't be, essentially mortared and bombed, and then had napalm drop on them, that they would literally be liquidated by the napalm and aerial ordnance of our supporting arms, and so normally they're pretty sensitive to those sounds. When they hear aviation, normally they begin to break contact, at least my experience in Iraq and Afghanistan. But this is the North Vietnamese, and so when the noise of the tanks began to, you heard them, and the sound of aviation assets overhead, did they slow down? Did they pull back, or did they keep coming?
Well, they kept coming up to a point. But when they started dropping the bombs and the napalm, especially the napalm, and we felt like we were being bombed because it was so close, Sergeant Burns was calling in airstrikes and telling them, to get as close as they could. And they were. And the napalm was it's so bad. I mean, you can't breathe when it sucks all the oxygen out of the air. But it kind of put a lot of them on the run, and by that evening, they were pretty much on the run. But some were still coming, and it was hard to tell. And what they were doing, they were taking the flak jackets and helmets off of the dead and putting them on. So it's kind of hard to tell who our enemy was at that point, other than they were smaller. Except for the Red Chinese that were mixed in, and they were bigger than us. So you really had to be careful, because it was hard to tell. We were just so mixed together. And
most guys, Daryl, when you talk about, your experience of having napalm drop that close to you, you're one of very few Marines that have had that experience in life. Even the guys at Khe Sanh, I mean, that stuff was dropped hundreds of meters away from them, and not in proximity as it was with you. I mean, I've read those same comments by survivors of Iwo Jima, who talk about what it was like to be in those caves when Marines fired flamethrowers at the mouths of those caves, and it just literally sucked all the oxygen out of the air. And
Yeah, we were rolling around on the ground trying to get our breath, just to breathe. And it was hard. It was hard to deal with that. But at the same time, we were thankful that it was there, because it really helped us. And
At what point, Daryl, during the day? So does the air check on station before the tanks get there? Did they come together as a package? Because I would imagine the first good view of what your battalion commander, had was the reports that the tanks were making and that the aircraft made to him in his CP back at Contien. I imagine those were the first good reports he had of what was going on with Bravo Company.
Yeah. At the time, it was hard to visualize really what was going on. And I just remember the tanks and the jets coming in. I don't know if it was at the same time or stage, But I know that they came. They came, and we needed them.
What so Darryl, talk about the rest of the day. How is you and your dozen Marines? Do you guys, after the napalm attack and air checks on station, do you guys sit tight? Do you continue to make your way to the south, or what happens the rest of the day with you guys?
No, we kept working our way towards the LZ to try to get the badly wounded there, which we finally did. And we loaded, I don't know, we filled the chopper full of wounded. And actually, they tried to get me on because I looked so bad. I had, you know, blood running down my face and my arms, and my clothes were covered with dirt and blood from me and from those guys that we had helped. And but I finally convinced them I was okay, and because we had guys that were really a lot worse than me. And matter of fact, at the end of the day, we had lost 59 of our Marines. Had been killed, and another 65 were critically wounded that we were trying to get out. And I was fortunate to be one of the 26 survivors. And most of us had been wounded at least once.
So 65 and 55 is 120 out of 100. So if you didn't hear, you know, the approximate strength of Bravo Company that day was 150. And
right.
You're talking about everybody, just about everybody in the company either killed or wounded.
Right. 26 of us were still able.
Well, but you said the majority of them would receive right. A Purple Heart for wounds that day.
Right. That's right. So, you know, it's kind of funny when we go to our reunions. We do it every other year. They used to say, everybody that has a Purple Heart, stand up. And now they started saying, anybody without a Purple Heart, stand up. That was Bravo Company.
The, you know, that's not supposed to be funny, but it is. If you're a grunt and miracle. Was anybody, were there guys who weren't hit? Was there anybody like that? Because I think we all learned that the God who governs the flight of metal through the air, right? He or she is a fickle person, right? How it misses one and gets another, or, you know, how instead of hitting you in the arm, it hits you in the arm, but it hits me in the jugular vein, right? You pull it out of your arm and I bleed to death. Like, and it doesn't make any sense.
Sure.
Is there anybody in Bravo Company that wasn't wounded that day?
Actually, there one that I might mention was our Staff Sergeant Gunny Burns, we called him. He had been through many battles before without wounds, and he managed to get through this one without being wounded. And he's the one that called in the airstrikes and everything that pretty much saved us.
And he's ultimately awarded the Navy Cross, yes?
Yes, yes. And we lost him a couple of years ago.
No, he's pretty much, you read about him, he's a pretty legendary figure in Operation Buffalo. And where did you encounter him that day, Darryl?
Well, as we were getting back closer to the LZ, we encountered him, and he was pretty much in charge because all the officers had been killed at that point. So he was the one making all the decisions.
And now he was the company gunny, or was he in charge of first platoon?
He was in charge of first platoon.
Got it. So you ultimately make your way.
He ended up being the company gunny, but at that point he was a platoon sergeant.
So tell me, so now you run a medevac where you're medevacing close to 65 Marines, and then what? Now there's two-thirds of a platoon left. Now what?
Well, now the enemy was pretty much on the run at that point. And so then we tried to gather up our dead, and we loaded them on the tanks to haul back to Trantian. And that was the worst part of it all, loading our.
No, those pictures, if anybody's seen those pictures and one's included in this post, again, that's why to me, Daryl, this conversation with Daryl is so important. You know, you read so much now, about, you know, us fighting the Chinese or the Russians and what it is to fight a peer. So the story that Daryl tells is of an enemy that fights you like a peer is going to fight you, that brings flamethrowers. And these pictures are indicative of the fighting that 1-9 did in the vicinity of Kantian the whole time they were up there, and their whole deployment up in Leatherneck Square in the northern part of the I Corps area of operation. But that's why I think this conversation is so important. And there's no relief, right, Daryl? It's not like, okay, come on, we're going to go back and we're going to sit down and we're going to talk to the mental health people because this was a really rough day, right? There's none of that.
All right. Well, and you know, the tank that came out, we had our company, well, actually it wasn't company commander at that time. He was one of the platoon sergeants that everybody really liked. Lieutenant Howell, and he was up at Conkey, and he's the one that got the tanks and came out with them, you know, and he was a short timer. He didn't have much time left, but he chose to come out and bring the tanks where we were, and he's another one that really rescued the rest of what was there. And
his name was Lieutenant Howell?
Yes.
After
we got all the dead that we could find loaded on tanks, and then some of us were designated to ride on the tanks and put them back to Trunky and to try to keep them from falling off. And that was a gruesome task.
No, I'll tell you what, just the pictures that you look at, they're not pictures we're used to seeing, which are, you know, our Marine bodies on top of Marine bodies. You know, we're not used to seeing that. I mean, the truth is, as Marines, you know, we're used to doing that to other people. We're not used to seeing that of our own. So you have that task of when you think back on a horrible day in your life, Daryl. I could hear the emotion in your voice talking about that ride back. On top of that tank, you've already lived through some pretty horrific stuff, to include, you know, you being wounded, and again, that thing hits you in the bicep, in the tricep area of your arm. What part of your arm did it hit you in?
Close to my shoulder.
Okay, so if you turn 4 degrees to your left if it was your left shoulder, that hits you right above the heart, right, and then Right, that's the difference between life and death on days like this. But yet, you know, the tank ride home or the tank ride back to Kantian, you know, obviously is as difficult as anything that you've been through that day. Yes or no?
For sure, it was.
So you go back to Kantian, and obviously you offload those guys. Then what? I mean, you still got to fight, right?
Well, at that point, they stayed at Kantian because they thought Kantian was going to be overrun.
Right.
And so we were on the defensive line to protect Kantian whenever they came for, which they really wanted Kantian bad, and that's the reason our main commander and all stayed there. And so we were there all night. And then our wounds and all were treated the next day, next morning. And that's when I borrowed some paper and pen because I had to leave everything I had in the field. And wrote my wife and told her that I was okay. And funny thing about that, she got that letter just within about 5 days. Normally it takes 2 or 3 weeks And then about what, 3 weeks later, she had a visit from somebody bringing her a telegram, telling her about it. But she thought it was another incident, so she was pretty upset about that.
Who was the telegram from? What did the telegram say?
It was from a commandant of the Marine Corps, telling her that I had, about my wounds and all.
Okay, that you had been wounded.
Right.
Yeah, you know, go ahead.
But it was scary because she didn't know it was that. She thought, you know, she's already been aware of that. She thought it was something more severe.
Got it. And just so everybody knows, I mean, if you didn't live during this time, I mean, when you would write a letter home, and if you had a question, right, in terms of, hey, I read there was a tornado, right, in Little Rock or in the area, you know, is everybody okay? That was probably a month to 6 weeks to get an answer on that question.
Right. So it took 2 to 3 weeks, seems like,
right,
to get the letters that were written.
Yeah. I mean, I'll tell you what, I mean, in 5 days, that means every place that letter went, it had to be the last letter in. And then somebody saying, hey, we're leaving, let me grab that. And it had to be that in Vietnam, in Okinawa, and probably Pearl, and then in the States. That might be a world's record.
Yeah. Well, you know, and sometimes it was even worse, like it'd get backed up, or I'd be moving from one place to another, and we'd get no mail for a couple of weeks, and then all of a sudden I'd get a stack of letters, because she pretty much wrote me every day.
Talk to me about the subsequent days. Now, 3-9 flies in, 1-1-3 flies in, and they head back into they head north, back into the area that around the marketplace and where Alpha Company fought. What were you guys still manning the perimeter at Contien during that, Daryl?
Yes, after that, they were out there, they were finishing up the battles, and they were trying to bring in the rest of our data that was out there, our companies, and everybody that had been out there that had been killed, they were trying to help bring them in.
Hey, Daryl, were there very many guys that were in 2nd Platoon and 3rd Platoon, which are all north of you, right, in the marketplace, so they're further north into the ambush. How many of those guys that were north of you actually got out of the ambush and survived?
Well, there wasn't many in the whole Bravo company. There were only 26 of us.
Only 26. And do you know how many of the 26 were from 3rd Platoon and 2nd Platoon? You have any idea?
I don't know for sure how many, just a few from each. And then our mortar section, there were like 8 of us, I think, that got out. So
we
ended up doing pretty good.
Yeah. Hey, everybody knows it pays to be a mortarman.
There you go.
Talk to me about, one of the things that most people don't know, that's pretty difficult when you experience casualties like this, is you have to go home and you have to take care of, and when I say home, you have to go back to wherever you guys stored your stuff at Contien, and you have to box up people's stuff and you have to send that stuff home. Did you have any part in that, Daryl? Did other people do that?
I did not. I had a part in unloading more that they brought in, you know, that kind of stuff. But as far as sending stuff home and packing up, I did not.
All right.
We pretty much stayed there and tried to regroup and build the company back up.
So how long did that take? When you're down to less than a platoon, you've got to rebuild the whole company. How long did it take before you guys were, you know, up and full up round and able to go outside the wire and conduct offensive operation?
Yeah, it took us about a month, and we still wasn't at full, but we were there about a month building up, and the bad thing was, now our company is pretty much all the new guys,
right,
you know, so we're pretty inexperienced, but we still, I still had 9 months to go. And
yeah, I was going to say, welcome to Vietnam, for God's sakes, right? Within your first, within your first 5 weeks, you experience the most difficult fight Marines would face in Vietnam during the entire Vietnam War.
Right. And, you know, the thing about it, Bravo Company had experienced pretty much that same thing right before I got there. I was one that built it back up to that point. And so it's like when I first got there, everybody's telling me, don't get in Bravo 1-9. Because they're always into the stuff. But I didn't have any choice.
Yeah. Besides, you were married, you were older, and a draftee, right? So
that's right.
You knew that, that's right. You knew that you belonged there. What the? Hey, look, other people might not belong here, but I think I do from everything I heard. The So Daryl, talk to us about in the aftermath of that day, as you build back up the company. What was the effect of that on the company? You guys who had survived it certainly had to be, you know, very, very influential members of the company. What was the impact of that? Did guys believe that the company was jinxed in some way, shape, or form? How did you guys deal with that?
Well, a lot of them really did. You know, they dealt with the fear and knowing the past experience that they would find out after they joined up. But I don't know. We kind of stuck together and managed to make the best of it, and tried to get the new guys trained as, you know, as quick as possible on what was going on, what to do, and how to react in situations. And we had other experiences where they, you know, they got their experiences, but it was a difficult time because we were so short and. We probably were out again by the time we built up to, I don't know, 75 or so. But we were still getting, every time we'd stop somewhere, well, we'd end up getting another Marine from the States or transferred over from somewhere else. And, you know, it took quite a while to build it back up to strength. I don't know that we ever did really full strength, but back up to kind of where we were.
Talk to me about when you reflect on that day, and I mean, I don't imagine there's a day go by that like most people that go to war, that you don't think about it, that you don't think about the friends that you had and lost. As you reflect on that day, as you've gotten older, and we'll talk about your book in the next segment, but as you reflected on that day, what were your thoughts? What are your thoughts?
Well, it's, you know, it's still there and it'll always be there.
Right.
And, you can't get away from it, but you can learn to deal with it. And there's a lot of different ways to help, you know, like get some counseling, which I didn't really want to do for, I don't know, 20, 30, 40 years, because I thought, well, if you had to have counseling, you were probably crazy. But I finally found out that is really what you need. And because I think I've come a long way in dealing with it. Like I say, it's always going to be there, but it gets lighter as the years go by. And as you talk about it and as you, you know, read about it and, I don't know, it's hard to deal with, but you have to deal with it.
You were spared that day. How do you,
yes.
And that a lot of people, really struggle with the survivor's guilt relative to that. How have you managed that? Because I'm sure you lost a lot of great friends that day, and you talked about you know, the ride back on that tank with guys who you knew, trying to keep, you know, the gruesome task of trying to keep their bodies from from falling off the tank. And then, you know, either the following day or a couple days later, when 1-3 and 3-9 had gone in, had headed to Contien, loaded bodies that were further north of where you guys were, and then came back, you guys, you helping, you know, unload those bodies as well. How did you make sense of your own survival? Have you?
I just feel like the good Lord was with me, because I was a Christian and have been for years, even before I was in the Marines. And he continues to guide me through that. And there are certain things that pop up that really help, you know, like counseling and writing about it, talking about it. And in our Marine Corps reunion, we've been to the wall, the Veterans Wall in Washington, D.C. And there's, you know, that's a difficult thing. I wasn't sure I could handle it, but we did. And there's all those guys are on that wall, and there's like 59 of them are on Section 22E, all right there together, because they're all killed the same day.
Right.
And that's a very hard thing, but it's an honor. It's an honor to be there. And to give them the honor and respect that they deserve.
And, you know, Daryl, I'll tell you what, of all the memorials I've ever been to, I believe that's clearly the most emotional one. I'm 62, so I was 10 years younger than a lot of the guys who served in Vietnam. But I was, you know, I was old enough to pay attention. And I remember when that memorial was first conceived, you know, there was a lot of Vietnam veterans who felt like, wait a minute. I mean, now even our memorial is going to be an anti-war statement or whatnot. And there was a lot of discussion about the nature of that. And I remember the first time I went, I was in Washington, D.C. because I was going to officer candidate school. And I went there at night the first time, and I was not prepared for the power of that memorial as you walk down into it, and you keep going down and down and down, and those tablets get taller and taller and taller. And on every one of those tablets, there's all those names. And you get to the bottom, and you look around, and you think, you know, good God, all these people with the only life they'll ever have. And I can imagine what it would be. I imagine it, there was some comfort in you guys going as a group together.
Right. Yeah. And we'd always present a wreath, and we'd divide up in our companies. And of course, Bravo Company was always the smallest because, you know, it never got filled back up.
Right.
So, yeah.
Right.
But, it's a great honor, and it's massive. It's when you think about all those lives, and not just them, but their families that dealt with it, you know.
Right.
It's incredible. It's terrible.
I got an email after the last podcast, and they asked me to ask you this question. There's a bit of a debate over the moniker, the Walking Dead. Guys who served in the unit during Vietnam didn't particularly care for it. Now it's the coolest thing in the world. You know, there's TV shows about it. And how do you feel about it?
Yeah, we're proud of the name now. Like you say, we weren't too proud of it back in the day because we thought it was a threat, which it actually was. You know, the NVA had threatened to wipe out our company because we caused such havoc for them. And not just my group, but the group before us. And they almost did, like, three different times. But we prevailed, and now we're proud to claim that we survived and we are the Walking Dead, you know. I know it sounds a little gruesome.
It does. No, I mean, most young Marines think it's cool as hell, to be honest with you. They don't rightly understand the origins of it. And I know some Vietnam veterans who bristle at it, saying, why do they still use that? You know, it doesn't connote anything positive that, you know, that happened. And so I wish, you know, I had one guy email me once and say, I've written letters, you know, and I wish they'd stop, you know, I wish they would, you know, really would stop using that. And so it's interesting, you know, again, like a lot of things relative to Kantian, it is not without controversy. It's not without controversy. I have one more question for you. What haven't I asked you about the events of, you know, 2, 3, 4 July that year that people ought to know if they're going to understand what happened during Operation Buffalo?
Well, we had some controversy over, we had a new commander. Some think that he wasn't ready. And
a new company commander or battalion commander?
Yeah. A company commander at that point that let us out. But, and the other thing is that, you know, there's so many guys that I remember that were so brave, you know, like Ronnie Fields that saved my life. And, by jumping out and taking two bullets for me. And, he survived. He came back to our company about 2 months later after he, you know, healed up somewhat. And, then guys like Billy Burns that I don't know how he used it, but he packed a sawed off shotgun and he took out a flamethrower with it. And, then we had a private, I think his name was Zimmerman, that he chased down an NDA with his bayonet. Of course, he was killed in the process, but he got the NDA. There were just guys that did pure heroic things, you know, to survive and to protect each other. And I think back on that, I think, yeah, we were a team, you know. And that's what you have to be. That's what you have to be.
So when we talk about fighting, you know, for Marines, it would be, you know, thinking about what it is to fight the Russians, what it is to fight the Chinese. The selfless lessons of that day are what come through in your head?
Yes, yes. You know, something I didn't mention, probably I should have, is I think I said my wife was pregnant at the time I was over there. Well, she delivered twin girls before I got home. So that was pretty exciting.
You know, you should have told the Marine Corps right when it happened. They'd have thrown your ass out. So it's not enough that you're older, that you're drafted, right?
Yeah.
Now you got twin daughters. Holy shit!
Yeah. As I was training for Vietnam, Marilyn called me and let me know that she was pregnant. And so I knew it on the way over, but didn't know there were two of them, of course. That was pretty exciting.
I can imagine. So how did you find out? Did you, one of the letters you got home? Oh, by the way, you know, I've delivered and we have two beautiful daughters. What?
We were at a place called the Rock Crusher. It was a mountain where they were taking rocks off to crush up to make road.
Right.
And we were protecting those guys. And I was on top of the mountain. My position was up there. And I was called down for a radio talk. And I got down at the bottom. And this guy told me, he said, your wife and babies are fine. And I said, I didn't say anything. He said, I was a corporal at the time. He said, Corporal Horn, are you there? And I said, well, yeah, I thought you said, like, plural. He said, yeah, your wife and daughters. You got twin daughters, and they're all doing just fine. And the other thing about that was, that night, that mail call, I got a letter from my mother-in-law telling me about it in pictures.
Oh,
and,
wow.
And a box of cigars from my father-in-law.
And so how did the guy who told you, was there a Red Cross message that somehow or other – took the slow boat to China.
Yeah. Well, you know, they had a hard time finding me. It took them like 14 days because we had moved quite a bit during that time. And they finally caught up with me and let me know. They were like 2.5 weeks old already.
And how much more time after, how much time till you saw that, your daughters in Maryland?
It was about 2.5 months. Yeah. 2.5 months. I got to see them.
Wow.
Because whenever my time ended in Vietnam, my time also ended in the Marine Corps. So I went straight home.
What, you know, Daryl, in the rest of your deployment to Vietnam, did anything, where you guys were the entire deployment up there, you know, by the DMZ in the northern part of I Corps, I mean, that was, you know, the whole time you were there, I mean, it was on with the NVA up there. Did you have any other experiences that came close to Operation Buffalo is kind of a, you know, you can't compare anything to that. But was the experience of your year there, was it that kind of fighting on a regular basis in terms of if they could catch you, they were going to come to wipe you out? Was that the nature of the fighting the whole time you were there?
It pretty much was. We didn't have another event like that one,
right,
you know, with that need. But we did have other contacts, and there were times when it looked pretty grim, but we always had, you know, the help that we needed at that point. And there wasn't, and the next thing was the last, I think, 30 days that I spent at Compiègne in November. It was November. And that was a very stressful time, that time. And of course, the other times were too, but this one in particular. I think I shared with you, we went 23 days with constant bombing, mortars, and rockets.
Well, plus you're a father with two daughters, and now you're a short timer, right? And thinking, look,
right.
I made it. I made it through, you know, July 2nd, and you know. But did you have the voice talking to you, Daryl, saying at some point your luck's running out up here?
Yeah, I was down to like 17 days, and I was begging, "Get me out of here! Get me out of here!" And you know what they did? They loaded me on a helicopter and sent me over to Quezon, and then the Tet Offensive was beginning at that point, and we were still getting mortared and rocketed, and I'm thinking, how am I going to get out of here?
Yeah, thanks for the favor. Thanks for the favor.
Yeah. But
no, when you read the story of Marines of 1-9, those are the places that you read about. You read about, you know, 1-9 at Contien. You read about 1-9 right. at Quezon, right? And so it's
right.
it's. And they're none of it, you know, 1-9 in the hill fights, you know, 1-9 at the rock pile. These are all names synonymous with ferocious fighting in 1967 and 1968. And yeah, don't do me any favors anymore. Stop sending me different places, man. This is awful.
That's right. You know, they were bringing the helicopter was bringing in the civilians and dumping them off, and we were loading on the chopper going back.
Yeah, I know. I know.
What's this all about? Yeah.
Wow. Well, Daryl, first of all, we'll do one more segment of this, and we'll talk about what it is to come home, because I think your story is a unique story, and your story with Marilyn is a unique story, and then how you coped with it, being a man of faith, a family guy, and then the writing of your book and the experiences subsequent to writing your book are all things that we'll cover in the next chapter. But I know this is not easy for you to do, and I just want to thank you because just in the last week, the number of people that have reached out to me saying, holy smokes, I listened to your interview with Corporal Horn, and I just want to say thank you. And when you get a chance, Mac, please thank him because – It's really interesting stuff. I did not realize the burden that individuals carried when they went to Vietnam by themselves. I didn't realize what a rough thing that was and the way we used to do it. And I'm pretty thankful for the way I went, you know, to Iraq and Afghanistan with my unit, that I felt comfortable the whole time. And so please thank both Daryl and his wife. And I had a number of people that, you know, they looked up your Facebook page, they looked up your book, and so hopefully they'll buy it. But no, I think your story is a great one, Daryl, and important. And so for the second time, thank you for doing this.
Sure. Thank you for having me. You know, it's like whenever I speak, it's hard, and I tell the people or I start tearing up. I remind them that Marines don't cry. Sometimes our eyes sweat. That's what happens when I start sharing this stuff.
I call it my allergies.
Yeah, there you go.
My allergies act up. Don't think I'm crying because I'm not, because Marines don't cry, but I do have a bad allergy problem. Right.
Right.
And
yeah,
so, I think that's an important example to set for not only, you know, I'm sure there's Vietnam veterans that have seen you speak and have thought, you know what, if he can do it, I can do it. And I think that example is an important one to set for them, because, I mean, some of them are still locked in that cage where they don't talk about it. And you know, right? And then after you retire, when you have so much more time, I remember asking my therapist a few years ago, and I was going in West Los Angeles, and right before I would go at 1 o'clock, there was a group of Vietnam veterans that would meet and do group therapy at noon. And so I'd get out of my truck, I'd be walking up, and they'd be standing outside. And I'd always talk to them like, "What's up, boys? What's going on?" And and so one day I said, you know, it's almost 50 years after Vietnam. What do you talk to those guys about? And he just looked at me and he said the same thing I talked to you about. He said, "Mac, they never dealt with it. They came home and none of this existed, and nobody wanted to hear from them, right? Nobody wanted to talk about Vietnam. And so they went home and they went to work." And so I'm always mindful, you know, Daryl, to first of all, when I speak, I ask if there's any Vietnam veterans there. And I always I say, on behalf of all of us, and I'll say this to you and your wife, thank you for what you went through, because we don't get treated like that anymore. Even among people that are adamantly opposed to the war, they never take it out on us. You know, we get called heroes and, you know, thank you for your service. And you know, if somebody knows that you've just come or gone and you're in a restaurant, they buy you your dinner and all that kind of stuff. And it's because people like you that went through what you went through, that we get treated so much different. But I do think it's important that we stand up and we're not afraid to talk about our experiences. And we're, you know, and even when we have our allergic reactions, we stand up there and we fight through those, because it's so important to show people that there's nothing wrong with us, that you can't go through that stuff and not have it stick to you. And it will make your allergies act up, but that's okay. That's absolutely normal for having gone through the experience that you've gone through. And I think that message in and of itself relieves so much pain, that there is nothing wrong with you. You cannot go through what you went through, certainly, without having it stick to you and impact you for the rest of your life. So it's okay to struggle, and you can get through it. And I think that message is the message that I get as I flip through your book, as I've looked through your Facebook page. And again, just can't thank you guys enough for agreeing to come on here and talk about it with me.
Well, you're certainly welcome.
All right. More of All Marine Radio coming up next, right here on the All Warrior Radio Network.